Well, we'll bring the Environment and Natural Resources Committee to order. It might not look like it, but we do have a quorum. There's been folks that have checked in. Representative Cox moves the minutes from March 8th. Everyone in favor of the minutes from March 8th, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, minutes are adopted. Let's see, we've got one, two, three, four bills on the agenda for today. House File 684, the Chair will move House File 684 to bring the bill before us. The motion will be to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. Mr. Meyer, are you ready to present our bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Director of Legislative Affairs for the Department of Natural Resources. House File 684 that you have before you today is one that we kind of call a rec tech bill. It's a recreational vehicle licensing, kind of technical amendment bill. We're trying to delete some language that we no longer use and bring as many of our bills, the statutes, up into par with current practices that are there. I know you have a fact sheet that's in your packet, so if you want to look at that, you can see that the bill does four things, and the summary lists them not in order, but I can kind of talk about them briefly. The first one is to extend the availability of our critical habitat license plates to recreational vehicles and camping trailers. We've heard from people who would like to do this. Of course, you no longer are required to put plates on boats or snowmobile trailers and things like that, so it would be for pop-up tent trailers such as that, or larger recreational vehicle, the mobile home types, not mobile homes, but the RV machines that you drive around. So we would allow that to go on, and we feel that we would probably get a couple hundred thousand dollars in added revenue at least, comparing it to the current registration rates and participation in the program. We have worked with the Department of Safety on this section, and we're working on an amendment that we'll offer. I believe this bill has to go to the Transportation Finance Committee at that time to allow those plates. They actually won't be applicable until January 1st, 2006, and the amendment will also deal with the question that we receive often about personalization of those plates as well. So we're working in conjunction with that department to make sure that what we're doing works for them and will work into the future. The rest of the bill the first section will allow for the use of temporary identification numbers on recreational vehicles registered through the telephone or the intranet. As we're moving into this technology more and more, we need to have this ability in statute. Also, you will see that we need to have the language to allow for refunds for certain recreational vehicle registrations and title fees. Sometimes these are the dealer pays for the registration, a person will come in and pay for the registration at a deputy registrar or over the phone or something, and we need to have the ability to make a refund where needed. And then finally, we also have language in here that we've been trying to take care of for a year or two, dealing with off-highway motorcycle decals and where they need to go. With that, Mr. Chair, I will briefly walk through the bill. You'll see on page 1, electronic transactions on 1.25 to 1.27. This is the language that we need to insert so that we can provide registration numbers through the internet or telephone. So if you do purchase a machine and you bring it home and you want to register it and get the numbers on there right away, you can get your plate on there and get out on the trails as soon as possible. Moving over into section 2, beginning on lines 2.24, the language that we're adding here on 3.7, actually striking from 3.6 and then inserting, deals with the 60-day temporary receipts. This is old language that was needed because of the paper system that we have. Now we're looking, and you'll see this language throughout each section of the bill. This first one deals with off-highway motorcycles. So that instead of a 60-day temporary permit, we have a 10-day temporary permit. We're turning these things around faster than that. If a person would have a problem not having their information within the 10-day period, they would be able to get another 10-day permit or else get the numbers in an expedited fashion just by calling or going to the deputy registrar's office. So we're trying to bring the system and the language into the 21st century. You'll also see page 3.5 begins actually the language for the motorcycle decal that we're looking for. This language will require the decal, registration decal for off-highway motorcycles to be affixed on the upper left corner of the rear license plate, or if the motorcycle is not licensed as a motor vehicle, has no license plate, we want the decal to be attached on the side of the motorcycle, and it may be attached to the fork tube so that it is visible while a rider is on the motorcycle. This language will provide a definite location for our enforcement officers in the field to look, make sure that there is a sticker on the plate or that people aren't sticking them on the frame somewhere, someplace that you can't easily see them. Section 3 there, beginning on 4.13, begins the refund language that I spoke of for off-highway motorcycles. If it's registered incorrectly by the commissioner or the deputy registrar, or if it was registered twice. So we're looking for language to be able to provide those refunds. Mr. Chair, Section 4 of the bill is language that we were hoping to get moved forward this session, but because of the definition of off-road vehicles, that does include all of our cars, our trucks, anything that could be taken off-road, and some people may think driving into your driveway could be off-road as well. So we don't want to proceed with this section of the bill because it takes into, may impact auto dealers throughout the state, and at this point in time, until we can correct that definition, we're looking to pull this section of the bill and continue working on that. So that takes care of that. Section 5 deals with the refund language on the off-road vehicles. And, Mr. Chair, if I may, line 6.6 after the semicolon, beginning with or, and through 6.8 would deal with that automotive dealer language as well. So that would be something we would like to strike out of the bill. Section 6 moves into the snowmobile registration. It's the same language that we have for the 10-day, going from the 60-day to a 10-day permit. Section 7 of the bill contains the refund language that's identical to the motorcycle language. Section 8, we're moving into the same language for snowmobiles and off-highway motorcycles, going from 10 days to 60 days. And Section 9 is the same refund language. Section 10 on lines 9.18, beginning there, deals with the refunds for watercrafts. Currently, we have the flexibility to issue the licenses, and it's a different, we can do the 10-day temporary permit with watercraft, but we have no language for refunds, so we want to insert that in there. And then finally, Mr. Chair and members, Section 11 of the bill deals with the expansion of the critical habitat license plates to recreational equipment, which we will be amending in the next committee.
Good job. The chair would make the motion to delete the entire Section 4, and on page 6, delete lines 7 and 8. Would that be the correct...
Mr. Chair, we need to go to the end of line 6.6 after the semicolon, I believe, and take out the word or as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes, and then take out 1 on line 5, so it and also the colon on line 4, so it just would continue to say within 12 months of the original registration and the vehicle was registered incorrectly by the commissioner or the deputy registrar, period.
Very good. Everybody understand the amendment? On the amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. To the bill. Any questions? Representative Dennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let's take the back, start from the back. The back page, pickup, truck, van, or of recreational equipment, and you alluded to amending something later or whatever.
What
very
page,
back
what page are you?
I'm on page 10, top line. Or maybe you didn't make the comment.
Ms. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pennis, yes. And I could bring the Department of Public Safety up if you would like to hear from them, but in our conversations just today, we finally got in touch with each other. We will be deleting the comma, inserting a period, and then inserting language, I think, that will say that these need to be used, or this will apply after January 1st, 2006, because we need to do some work with the system and the design. And then we'll also be inserting language that deals with the personalization of these plates as well. If you'd like the specific language, we can probably give it to you right now, I think. I don't have it right here in front of me.
Representative Pence, you want them to come forward? This is going to be my amendment, and they're actually kind of helping me out on this thing. With I want to move it to be able to have a personalize these plates, and it's going to be a new plate. It's going to be a new critical habitat plate.
Okay.
And we'll have that all in transportation finance.
I'm fine with that. Could you just tell me what's the gamut of recreational equipment?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, members, the definition in statute, and I don't have that right in front of me, includes large, I don't want to call them RVs, you know, the traveling campers, motorhomes, I guess, is the right definition. You know,
plus camper trailers,
and plus camper trailers and things of that nature.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, the chair would renew his motion that House File 684 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Bill is passed on to the Transportation Finance Committee. Good job, Mr.
Thank
Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Chair would move House File 1605 to bring the bill before us. Bill needs to go to the Agriculture, Environment, and Natural Resources Finance Committee. And if Mr. Franzen would like to come down.
I did. Look at this paper.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Franzen. I'm an attorney representing the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association, and we are here to testify in support of this legislation. With me is the president of our association, Mr. Harold Brace, who came down from Walker, Minnesota, to be with us today. My role simply is to explain what the bill does, and then I think Mr. Brace can explain at length why we're pursuing this. Mr. Chairman, for almost 25 years now, I've come before this committee telling you that Minnesota has the finest snowmobile trail system in the country. Unfortunately, that's not my report today. For a variety of factors, our snowmobile trails are not what they should be. And this bill seeks to remedy that situation, to put us back where we belong as Minnesotans, is number one. It is a fundraising mechanism. We want to raise new funds. We want to raise these funds from ourselves. Currently, under Minnesota law, if you're a tourist coming to Minnesota, you pay $15 for what we call a trail permit or a sticker. That entitles you to ride your snowmobile on the state trails and the Grant and Aid Trail systems. What we've done is extend that fee to residents as well as non-residents and doubled it. So it would cost $30 a year under this legislation to ride your snowmobile on state trails or Grant and Aid trails. Let me point out, it would cost nothing if you want to go from your cabin to the ice house, private property. There are other snowmobile uses other than trail riding, which this bill would not affect. Now, this revenue raised is specifically directed under this legislation to be used for Grant and Aid purposes. What we're using this bill, this money for, I think we find in Section 2 of the legislation, starting with lines 23, and it's, first of all, to pay an adequate level to reimburse snowmobile clubs on their maintenance costs. Right now, snowmobile clubs are, I think inadequate is a gentle word if you talk to the people and the volunteers who actually do this. By way of comparison, the state pays itself in excess of $70 per hour to groom a trail, not under a public accounting system, Whereas right now, the private clubs who do it under contract get less than 50. I believe it's 48. There's a significant differential. And then when you equalize for the public versus the traditional private accounting and some of the efficiencies inherent in government, we say we should at least be equal in reimbursement to what the state pays itself. We think it's somewhat over $80. We put an $80 threshold on this legislation. And again, in terms of maintenance costs, we have a 90-10 split, that 10% is volunteered, 90% is actually reimbursed from this new fund. Currently, the ratio, the split, is 65-35. It's a 65-35. 35% is expected to be involuntary. And then finally, on page 2, subdivision 6, section 3, it addresses, in I think a fairly comprehensive and forward-looking manner, an issue that's come before this committee before, and that is permanent easements for recreational trails. The issue has last come before this committee with relation to a town up in northern Minnesota, just south of Duluth, Hermantown, where the urban sprawl is encroaching on recreational trails. And what we hope to do is to be able to create an ongoing mechanism where the state can work with clubs and communities to preserve recreational opportunities in situations like this. Our means to accomplish this are twofold. One is we appropriate money, and secondly, we create a position within the DNR to specifically look out for these issues, identify them, and move forward towards permanent trail easements. Those are the issues that we hope to address with this legislation. Let me say that only controversy I have heard at all is, again, on the imposition of the $30 permit. Let me give you two editorial pieces, which Mr. Brace will expound on. First of all, if you snowmobile in other states, particularly those states where you find your experience may even be superior to that of Minnesota, they all have this funding mechanism in the eastern part and in Canada. Secondly, I spend most of my recreational dollars in the winter in downhill skiing, which costs me approximately $30 to $50 per day, not per season. So I think it's by way of comparables, if the equivalent for my sport as a downhill skier is probably about 10 times what we're asking for here. So the reality is there is cost to recreation, and MinUSA has always been very proud of paying our own way. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my explanation of the bill. I'd certainly be willing to stand for questions or to turn it over to Mr. Brace.
I think we'll turn it over to Mr. Brace, and then if we have any questions, we'll have you both up here to answer them for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Harold Brace, President of the Minnesota United Snowmobile Association from Walker, Minnesota. And looking at this, when we come up with this, I did some equipment costs calculations, being in the construction business most of my life, I know how to figure out equipment cost. And the new groomers today are averaging $137,000 to $165,000. 10 years ago, they were half that much. So if you take a $137,000 groomer and keep it for 7 years, and an average of 300 hours a year that you're grooming, which is pretty good if you can get that many hours in, you got a $65 an hour replacement cost that you should be putting away every hour to replace that groomer. You pay labor now. We don't longer have volunteers operating this. Most of it's all payable now, and we have to carry workman's compensation on them. We have to carry Social Security. We pay that so that our operators are getting an average of $12 an hour. Fuel costs, as you already know, what diesel fuel has done is doubled. The average groomer gets around 5 to 6 gallons per hour usage. So we got around a $10 an hour cost for just operating our fuel. Maintenance cost is around $7. Insurance comprehensive is $5. Trail liability is going up. That runs $5 an hour. So if we look at our actual cost, that's $109.20. That's what it's costing us. Now, in our club, go buy a groomer, the board has to sign the note at the bank. We have to know how we're going to pay for this. And if you add the interest on top of that over a 7-year period, you got around another $17 an hour in interest funds. So we're operating at $48 an hour now. We can't keep going on. So we end up with the $80 an hour because of the fact is that a lot of the clubs that are in gambling, pull tabs, can justify the $80 an hour along with their pull tab. So that's how we come up with that cost. Then you have to have a building to maintain this. So your building's going to cost you $80,000 to $100,000. You have to have heat in it. The cost of operating that building in a year is around $14,000 for taxes, heat, lights, maintenance, and that comes off the grooming cost. That's why you have your building. So that's one of the reasons that we're coming up with this idea of funding so that we can pay for this stuff. We're tired of selling hot dogs. We're tired of raffles. We're tired of all this. We want this to be paid for by the snowmobiles. Then we come up with the concept of going to 90-10. That cost would run around between $2.7 and $3 million a year. We come up with a 90-10 change for maintenance, and that's $1 million a year. Then we feel very strong that we've got to do something to protect our trail system. If any of you read this article, it was just in the St. Paul paper. It talks about how much land is being purchased by developers. I live in Cass County, and I'm on the Cass County Planning Commission. And I see it in the southern part of our counties where developers are coming in and buying a whole farm. 200 acres of land, 260 acres of land. Our snowmobile trail is gone. So we have to do something to maintain this trail system. In another 25 years, we will no longer have a trail system or less, because the land is being gobbled up. So we believe that we should put a $500,000 aside for that purpose and another $150,000 a year so that the DNR can hire one or two people to be full-time in this acquisition. Be able to keep on top of things throughout the state. Potlatch, as some of you know, is selling a lot of land for hunting, getting rid of it. And we have a trail going through there. We'd be able to get in on the ball and try to buy that 40 acres of land. And maybe take our, what we're doing in Cass County is we're buying the 40 acres, taking the trail out, and then reselling the 40 acres. And it doesn't cost us anything. So we need that to be done. That runs to about $4.6 million a year. And depending upon how many snowmobiles we get registered, but out of the 270,000, why, $30 is what we need. And then we have two more other things. In 1997 and 2001, we did trail studies. Put it together, what we wanted to do in the state of Minnesota. We haven't done a heck of a lot of that. Done nothing. We proposed a bridge over Highway State Interstate 35E up in Hinckley so that the snowmobiles can get from one side of the freeway to the other. That's all part of the studies. There's money left over. We propose that those requests become reality and that it gets completed. That's the big reason why we're asking for this trail permit.
Good. Anything further, Mr. President?
Mr. Chairman, no, except to reaffirm that the source of what we want to do, the funding source, is again snowmobilers, and not only snowmobilers, but that snowmobilers who use state and grant and aid trails. And the uses of these funds are all for the betterment of snowmobiling, and it's, we're all talking within the context of our of the dedicated fund. So there is no general fund implication to any of this. So I mean, our main policy requests of the committee are very simple. We'd like to get an affirmation of at least our thought that it's snowmobiling is worthwhile enough to pay $30 a year to do. And that we have some good ideas on how to use the money that will actually better our sport and make it better for everyone.
I just come from out east snowmobiling. New Hampshire cost me $100. Quebec cost me $175. Maine was $100. Vermont was $100.
For all the state
permits. Anybody. Stickers. Anybody that snowmobiles there. Yeah. And from the looks of the snowmobilers that I run into, it didn't affect the amount of snowmobiles on that trail, so I'll tell you that.
Questions? Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brace, Mr. Franzen, I appreciate the work that the Snowmobile Association does on this. I think you've had a very sensible approach to working together and trying to address issues that are out there and not trying to necessarily point fingers and say that it's somebody else's responsibility. I appreciate that stepping forward and talking about a fee increase. Question I have is I don't know how much a $30 fee increase raises, and I don't know if you have that, but also does the way I'm reading the bill here, is the fee is enough to cover this 90% cost is what you're anticipating, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, we believe it will be. Of course, with any fee increase, you have the uncertainty of price elasticity. You may have some people dropping out because they don't want to pay the $30. And there is some controversy. Not every snowmobiler wants to pay $30 for a snowmobile. We believe that pricing issue is de minimis. And if we had every registered snowmobile in the state buying this permit, which we don't anticipate, we would have more money than we could ever spend. And I don't know in terms of where we're pricing. We're still working with DNR Trails and Waterways on specific amounts that would be raised from this.
Ms. Franzen, something close to what we think we might raise.
We believe that there is parity, that the $30 is sufficient to meet the expenditures we envision in this bill.
270,000 snowmobiles in Minnesota. If we get 200,000 of them to buy the sticker, that's $6 million.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think I heard you address the other question I had. Obviously, the big economic impact on tourism and everything in the state with snowmobiles. But this $30 is, from what you've kind of indicated, it's reasonable in line with what other states are charging. We're not pricing ourselves out of the game here. Okay.
Not a bit. It's very expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Cox, as well, right now non-residents, tourists coming in are accustomed to paying a $15 permit. Mm-hmm. And that's for the entire trip. I don't believe it makes a lot of sense that if I'm planning a snowmobile trip with all it entails, trailering, snowmobiles, and hotels and motels, that the total, an increase in the total cost of $15 is going to deter me, because we have some economic studies where when people come in from other states to enjoy our snowmobile trails, they spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars every day.
Mm-hmm.
So we think the impact of this on tourism is de minimis at best.
And
thank you.
Mr. Franzen, some of the surrounding states, they've got similar stickers, or Mr. Race. You know what?
Michigan is going $25. Wisconsin is $18, and they'll follow us. And then you go west to Idaho, and those places are in the $20 to $30 bracket. Out east, it's much more expensive. And I could really see the difference in the trail conditions when I saw what the permit is doing.
Hmm. Further questions? Representative Dill.
Thank you. I wanted to really give a little testimony from my experience. I've been a trail administrator now through this program for 20 years, where I actually am the person that organizes and does the requesting of funds and does the maintenance of the groomers and buys the groomers and deals with the buildings and the heat and all the things that President Brace talked about. And I can tell you that in a community that is a tourism community, like where I live, or a tourism area, that the amount of money that is given for maintenance and grooming is grossly insufficient, not only in terms of the hourly rate, but the overall amount of expenditures. And I'd like to tell you that our snowmobile club organization at times has reached as high as running an ancillary business of $10 million a year in income for pull tabs. That's $10 million of gross receipts for pull tabs so that we can make ends meet. And it's very difficult to get the surrounding businesses to give enough so that it's meaningful, enough additional funds. And it's very difficult to get people when you live in these tourism communities that are particularly small, because you don't have the human resources to actually come out and work on the trails. Because when you live in small communities, you have a small amount of resources, but yet we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of trail to maintain. And so then as the as the process has evolved over the years, over this 20 years, and our volunteer base, which is again small, I'd say less than 10% of snowmobilers statewide, maybe 15, that work on these trails as volunteers or quasi-volunteers that get paid some amount. They go into, I'm going to give you an example, they go into a restaurant in my community after spending the whole day volunteering out on the trail, and they go in to buy a beer or a pop or a dinner, and they sit at the bar, and the bar is totally, or the restaurant, and there's 200 people in there spending $60, $70, $80, $90, $100 for dinner, and they do that once, and then they go back out on the trail and work again, and they say, this doesn't add up. I mean, like, the owner didn't even, like, say, can I buy you a beer? That kind of thing. And so it starts to feed on itself, and it just leads us to more need for more income to supplement the trail. And I'm not vilifying this group of people, but in these northern communities, as I go home at night on Friday night from here, I might pass 100 different units with snowmobiles. And they are generally for SUVs, Suburbans, Excursions, whatever all those SUVs are. They generally have four snowmobiles. Many of them are enclosed with six. They have $100,000 worth of rolling stock. They roll into the city of Grand Rapids. They rent a motel for $90 a night for a couple. They go to somewhere and spend $50 for dinner minimum. And then they go snowmobiling for a day, and some of them might go to Giants Ridge and pay $50 for a ski pass for the day to ski on the hill. And these are people that are snowmobilers. And so I think you can see where that's going. Something that is incredibly important in this whole scheme of things, and Representative Osmond and I and Hackbarth have talked about this a bit, is the idea that the public, the land that has been quasi-public over these last decades, meaning paper companies, power companies, that land has been quasi-public, and that land has been available for use to develop snowmobile trails. And I'm in Grand Rapids, we'd be talking about Blandon Paper Company, and I'm going to give you an example. Boise just sold their 309,000 acres of land in Minnesota during this part of Boise Cascade becoming a private company. And they sold it to a timber management organization in Boston. I know virtually every management person as a trail administrator at Boise Cascade. And on my landowner list that I'm an administrator for, I have over 100 crossings of Boise land. And now a company from Boston bought this land, and I feel very much vulnerable in that one piece of land that they might sell could break that chain, because a snowmobile trail is a chain, you know, of ownership. And the less ownership you can have, the easier it is to maintain the chain. And so that's the reason I think, even though $500,000 is a small amount in the scheme of our statewide snowmobile trail system, it's a start, and I'd support that. Now lastly, the ice fishermen. There are people that do not ride on Grant and Aid snowmobile trails. They just do not. They ride on their farm. They ride out on a lake on public water to go ice fishing. And however else they use the snowmobile on deer hunting trails to go retrieve a wild game, big game. Those people would not be affected by this item, because they are required to have a registration like our current law, but they would not be anticipated or expected to buy one of these trail passes because they are not operating on a portion of the state or the Grant and Aid trail. And so that's kind of an accommodation in how we got to this point. There are going to be a lot of unhappy people. They got to pay $30 more a year to snowmobile, and it's a hardship for some families. Could be a hardship for families that have multiple. For me, it's going to be 90, and I've already had constituents that call, well, we've got five snowmobiles, and we have five riders, and it's real money. But I can tell you that we are getting very near the cliff of losing our volunteer base, because they have to sell hot dogs, T-shirts. We have to gamble in our own communities to support a tourism industry. If we're going to gamble, we should be spending money on hockey rinks, and we should be spending money on youth intervention and programs, after school enrichment, and things like that with our gambling money. That's my view. And not continuing to subsidize the snowmobile industry. even though it's good, we need to step up to the plate and do it ourselves. So that's my speech.
Very good. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just have a couple of questions. I live in the South, so I'm in Austin, and when people go to, they can travel somewhat around that area and do some snowmobiling, but when they want to go, they're traveling 4 to 10 hours to probably get to, you know, lots of trails. And so what I just have a question. You talked a little bit about the Minnesota and Wisconsin, the difference or perhaps the similarities in the fees. I'm just wondering about the numbers of miles of trails and also if I understand this correctly, what you're hoping to do is people will pay more, but they're going to get increased value. They're going to get more trails. So just if you could talk about that, since the people that I would represent would look at Minnesota or Wisconsin, perhaps, to actually go. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me answer part of the question, then I'll throw the hard part over to Mr. Brace. You will not necessarily get more trails if this bill is enacted. What you will get is a better snowmobile experience. After your constituents go 4-6 hours to go to a destination, the quality of the snowmobiling would be much better because the trail will be groomed, it will be safer because it's marked, and it will continue to meet some relatively high standards we like to place among ourselves. If the funding goes down, that's when you don't groom quite so often, you don't. And that would be the primary impact your people would see, is a better experience. And I would argue that on a $30 a year basis, if I'm in Austin going to Grand Rapids or up at the Arrowhead, I'd gladly pay that for the quality, considering the time I'm investing in that recreational experience. So let me throw the tough part over to Harold.
Mr. Franzen, and if I can answer some of that, the problem here is that these clubs that are out there and buying the groomers and grooming the trails, and they don't have the volunteers that they used to have, the problem is going to be eventually, if we don't do something with this, that those trails are eventually going to be closed. They're not going to be groomed. They're not going to be even open to snowmobiling if we don't have somebody out there grooming the trails. So that's ultimately what's going to happen. And we want to keep the trails open. We want to keep them groomed. We want to keep the clubs functioning properly. And I think that's really where this the gist of this bill. I think we've got about 18,000 miles of 20,000 miles of trail in the state of Minnesota.
Do you know what there is in Wisconsin?
I don't.
17, I believe.
Yeah, I thought it was more.
Thank you.
Anything you wanted to add, Mr. Brace?
Told Harley, Mr. Chairman, that we might not be there.
Mm-hmm.
We have to buy a new groomer. Our club and marker, we don't know how we're going to pay for it. And if we don't buy a new one, we will not be grooming.
Mm-hmm.
Club will go out of business, and the trails won't be groomed.
They won't be.
Chairman.
Representative Bill.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And President Brace touched on another item. There are communities that are out there, not a lot of them, but there's a fair amount of trails that are connecting trails,
mm-hmm.
that are to communities or connect communities or connect communities to the main thoroughfare that are in the study that President Brace discussed or at least referenced that can't get added to the system. And so a community is like not getting added to the county road system because there isn't money in the fund today to pay for the maintenance and grooming of those trails. Now, it's not a huge amount. I'm not sure what the inventory of those are relative to the whole size of the system, but they do exist, and so there are communities that are being penalized because they can't get into the system because there is no money, not even to pay the grooming operators we've got enough, but for new trails that we might want to add or consider.
And that's in the 97 and 2001 study. For example, from Deer River to Grand Rapids, there's nothing. From Deer River to Reamer, there's nothing. It's proposed. We got to go across the Mississippi River. We need a bridge, and we need to work with the Forestry Service and all. So there's communities that are kind of left out of the system that need to be into the system.
Representative Pop.
Could I ask just one more question about this? When you're talking about the money that's going to be used for the person or people that are going to be the acquisition coordinators, will that help to increase the trails? Or I guess that's where I was kind of getting at, is that it helps to maintain it, but does it, you're trying to see, make sure that there are opportunities for more trails, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's absolutely correct. What we've seen in Furman Town, and we're seeing in terms of developers selling large blocks of land or buying large blocks of land, is essential connections in a quality trail system could be lost forever, which would ultimately lead to degradation of the entire system. And with this position, and we don't know if it's one or two, we're still in conversation with the DNR, and some funds to do some limited acquisition, we believe at least we have a start at saying, no, we can preserve this recreational opportunity for our people.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To that point, Representative Dale?
No, another item.
Representative Osman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to talk to my local snowmobilers about this, and it has support as long as the dollars are going to the Grant Nades Trail, so I'm really pleased that that's quite clear that that's where the money is going to go. And the other question we had is that because many of them did not want to have another sticker on their snowmobile. So I'm wondering if there, for those that when they buy registration, and those are for 3 years at a time, I believe, if there's any discussion on being able to buy a registration that would actually include the 3 years that the sticker could potentially cover, if you're willing to pay the 3 years rather than just the 1 year at a time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osman, we've had those discussions about the point of even encouraging three-year buys, whereby you might give a price break. We've also had some internal discussions and some preliminary discussions about maybe for the family of five or something, having a family packet. The sticker or putting tax IDs and those things in snowmobiles is a particularly sensitive subject for a lot of members who pay a lot of money for these machines and take great pride in the way they look. Would hope, and again, I don't know the answer. That's something that would ask DNR. Some other states have a little windshield sticker. It would be really nice if you could incorporate it somehow into the existing registration data. I don't know that. Hopefully, those issues in terms of the three-year purchase, the family pack, if you will, those would be issues that we would have probably a firmer opinion on by the time this came to the next committee and be able to address this in finance. I think we'd have to be able to do that for your committee to do its job.
Representative Osman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to work with the author on that and see if we can get some of those things to settle, because there's a lot of support for this money if it can go towards what it's supposed to be, and if we can do it in the least amount of visual impact on the snowmobiles also, and to make it easy. When people are buying a three-year registration, they just soon buy their three-year trail access at the same time. And so if that could just, if we can work with DNR to try and get that all incorporated into one.
Mr. Chairman, can I address that?
Mr. Brace.
We have gone that way in the past, and every time we've gone that way, we've been burned.
In what regard?
In regards to putting a license increase. Because then that money goes into the pot, and it's appropriated by you people. And it isn't always appropriated out of there.
Well, I don't think that's what Representative Osmond's talking about.
We're
talking about keeping the money separate and going for it.
If we keep the money separate, then we would be...
Yeah, we're not talking about combining money.
We don't want to give the...
I think you misunderstood.
...any more money.
Yeah. Just combining the sticker, Mr. Chair, is on, not the money.
And Representative Osmond, I think that you and I and Representative Dill and Representative Box are going to have to sit down with the DNR and talk about some of these things, along with Mr. Bryce and Mr. Franzen, before we hear it in your committee.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Dill.
Okay, I have one item that I do think is important that we do consider, and it sounds like we're going to have like a little group to talk about these things, is that I think I feel like this is going to be a point-of-sale thing to a lot of people. They're going to buy a snowmobile, they're going to register it, and then they're going to then say, I need to get a sticker. And so I think we need to make sure that we have this available through the ELS system. And I like the idea of what you're talking about, Representative Osmond, but that ELS is also going to be an important component of how this system would work. And my last thing is the percentage of snowmobile registrations. I have received some information that Wisconsin has about 300,000. Maybe President Brace can talk about that. 300,000 snowmobiles, and they get about two-thirds of their stickers. So some of the financial assumptions that we have been working with as a group comes from our neighboring state, and the percentage of registrations that they get versus the total number or trail passes versus registration. And the last item, and I'd like to ask Mr. Chairman, if I may, President Brace, what is the, you know, how close I live to Ontario, half a mile, and what is their registration a year in Ontario?
$160.
So for a resident or a non-resident, Mr. Chairman, it's
$160? A non-resident goes up there for 7 days, it's $100.
For 7 days.
So
7 days.
We have, so Mr. Chairman, point I'm making is we've got one neighbor, even their foreign neighbor, they have a much higher than any of our neighboring states around, you know, Wisconsin and the other states and neighbors.
Representative McNamara.
No questions.
Okay. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this can be answered by either the author or the president. I'm an avid snowmobiler. I grew up snowmobiling, got my license the earliest I possibly could, and I went out in southeastern Minnesota. We have a number of trails down near the Rochester, Wabasha, along the river, Lake City area, Red Wing, and I thoroughly enjoy it, but my one concern is that if we start down the road of easements, and I understand the need for this, especially around the larger cities, especially around those areas where there is a lot of development taking place, in order to keep that trail through the area, we need to have an easement. But I'm wondering if we start down that road of having permanent easements, could we potentially start raising questions with the other landowners that we go through their land to develop these trails, that at some point they want a dollar amount for the access to their property? And I raise that because I have noticed over the years a number of landowners who have allowed the trail to go through their land, and then no longer will they allow that. So then the trail association has to go out and find other landowners. They end up having to make a major shift in the trail to account for that. But I'm just wondering, you know, if we start with $1 amount now to acquire land for trails, could that potentially lead to more dollars needing to be available in the future to other landowners saying, I don't get any money for my land?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think that's an excellent question. The possibility is once you create a fund, everyone will go seeking it. We think not. Don't know not, but we think not for a couple reasons. The first of which is most landowners are members of their community and they're snowmobilers themselves and they're in their club, and there's that particular sense of community in greater Minnesota. You don't see that. Secondly, actually three reasons. The second is we're really targeting this to property that may be put up for sale, or as opposed to I want money to run across my land. And the third, and which I think is a very compelling reason to landowners, is right now if you permit the public to use your land for recreational purposes, you have significant liability protection, which you do not have if you charge money. In fact, right now, if you do the right thing for the people, and this is not limited to snowmobiling, it's any recreational use, if you do the right thing, your legal position is actually better than if some trespasser came onto your land. So we think with those three factors, the concern you raise is legitimate, but they lead us to believe it won't come about.
One of the big things that we're concerned about up north, potlatch is probably in Cass County alone selling 150 different parts of the land. The mining companies are getting rid of land. The railroad companies are getting rid of land. And we have a significant amount of trails that cross that property. And in order to protect our trails, we're going to have to do something to protect the system.
Any further discussion? Okay, with that, the chair renews his motion. Anybody from the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? I was going to have the DNR, Trails and Waterways, come up, but I think we'll have that little discussion with Representative Osmond, Phil, myself, Senator Bach, and the DNR, and we'll all get together with you folks and hammer a few other things out before we get to Representative Osmond's committee. So, with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 1605 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Agriculture, Environment, and Natural Resources Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion fails.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Brace. Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Representative McNamara. Members, we've got Representative McNamara's bill and Representative Johnson here. Okay. Sheldon Johnson has a bill before the committee, and we're going to try to get that one in, too. We ready?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1438.
Representative McNamara moves House File 1438 to be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse
me.
Does it have to go to GovOps? Oh. I guess we're going to have to send it to GovOps. Are you okay with that?
Mr. Chair, you're the boss. We're ready to go to GovOps. Do you want me to renew that motion, or you got it covered?
Yeah, we've had a request from GovOps, so we have to send it to GovOps.
Okay.
Please proceed with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me to explain the bill, with me this afternoon to explain the bill is Assistant Director of Forestry Bob Tomlinson.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tomlinson, Assistant Director of the Division of Forestry. I'll give you the reasons why we're doing this and kind of walk through the bill. And I also have with us in the audience is Craig Engwald, Special Assistant to the Commissioner, if we want to have more specific questions related to the process, we'll ask him to come up and respond to those perhaps at that time.
Okay.
But basically, the DNR Division of Forestry has a state forest road system that amounts to about 2,175 miles at last count. This is obviously throughout the forested parts of the state, and as you're well aware, based on discussions over the last few months, and as with the previous discussion here, that road system goes across numerous parcels of private land, county land, township land, industry land that is owned by folks other than the DNR Division of Forestry, the public, basically. However, the DNR has officially inventoried these roads, and we have designated them as part of the state forest road system in the past. And I should mention that most all of these roads are established decades ago. Some of them might be 60, 70, or even older than that, years old. And as they go across these private lands, there has been no official recording of these, what we refer to as prescriptive easements in the county offices in the past, except on a piece-by-piece type of a basis. We feel it's in the interest of the state in order to guarantee access in the future to these state forest land holdings and to the public for forest management purposes and recreation and otherwise, to go through a process of officially recording the prescriptive easements on a county-by-county basis throughout the state. The reason we want to do this in the process that's laid out in the bill is because there are probably 20 to 25,000 or so parcels throughout the state that these state forest roads cross. And to try and go out and do each of these independent of the other would take us literally decades. And so what we've done is we look back at the legislation that was passed several years ago relative to the townships when they went through a similar process, and we basically come up with legislation in House File 1438 that closely resembles the township legislation. I should also mention that Chapter 89.71, which deals with State Forest Road, already gives us the authority to designate, inventory designate, and record the forest roads. It's a recording that we haven't kept up with over the years and done that. So going through the bill, Subdivision 1 basically lays out the authorization for this. We feel that it's important to have statutory authorization because it will lend us credibility to the process, and it will also provide for a transparent process and fair notice to the landowners that might be affected by this. Subdivision 2 provides for the map requirements. What we're proposing is to go in on a county-by-county basis, do the inventory of the roads that are in existence. I would point to line 16. It says show state forest roads at the time the map is adopted. It would not be state forest roads that might come in after that and otherwise, but it would only be for those that are currently in existence. Subdivision 3 on the next page lays out the procedure on how we would adopt the map. We prepare the an official map for each county or a smaller geographic area if that makes more sense as determined by the commissioner. And we'd set a time and a place and a date for a public hearing. Also, I would bring your attention down to line 15 on the bill on page 2 where it says at least 30 days before the hearing, the hearing notice must be sent to by mail the property owners directly affected. Those would be the folks where the road might be going right across their property and would have the most interest, obviously, in the hearing to make sure that they're aware of it. Most all of this language, as I said, comes right from the township language out of statute 164.35. Subdivision 4 on the last page, page 3 of the bill, lays out a process where there would be an appeal. We hope there wouldn't be too many of these, but in the sense that there might be, we'd want to sit down with each individual landowner and see if we couldn't work out a different solution to it, perhaps, than it might be. It might end up meaning changing the road or changing the use of it if it wouldn't restrict other folks, those sorts of things like that. But trying to work things out short of having the things end up in court is what our objective would be. In section subdivision 5, want to make it clear that we're only dealing with the state forest road system. We're not talking about other trails such as you just talked about with the snowmobile trails or OHV trails or other things like that, but just what's currently part of the 2,175-mile road system. And that, in essence, is the bill as we brought it forth. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Wiggins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, when you're dealing with property rights, as you are in this bill, I'm trusting that you're going to take it to the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chair, of course, that's your folks' call over here, but I don't want to say you should do it as a Senate, but they passed it out of the Policy Committee there and right back to the floor, so I'm not sure where to go.
Okay, then.
At that regard.
Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, I'll be glad to check with the chair and see if he wants to hear it, and if he does, we'll go from, I believe we're being referred to
Bill Ops.
To Chair Tingle's at the committee from here, so in the interim, I will check, and if they want to hear it, I'll take it there, too.
Representative Wiginius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then let me bring up the one issue that just jumps out at me, and that is the hearing notice sent by mail to property owners directly affected in the county. One of the things that may happen here is you will send out the notice, and the property owner will say, I didn't get the notice. This is down the line, 2 years from now, 10 years from now. It seems to me that I would want to visit with the Judiciary Committee and ask if it wouldn't be better to spend a little money up front and send out a certified letter rather than just a hearing notice in this, and a certified letter that you would keep on record in the basement of DNR forever. So that would be one of the things that I would want you to ask in some other committee. And along with that, the on line 31, you're talking about using aerial photographs to establish road center lines. Is this going to be your general practice? Will you be doing, what is it, GIS positioning on some of these, or is it just all going to be aerial?
Mr. Thomason?
Mr. Chair, Representative Virginia, we have all these roads right now are pretty well defined with GPS, and we would rely heavily on that. Well, Mr. Chair, just in response to something you brought up, Representative Guinness, I guess I'd want to make the point that we also feel that by doing this, we would be assuring access to those private holdings as well, that the private landowners will probably benefit from this as the state will. Representative Dill brought up earlier there the situation with the Boise lands and the uncertainty of what might occur with that 300 and some thousand acres, and that's a pretty good example where there might be currently private land holdings other than the Boise, back in those large blocks along which state, and by us going through this formal designation process will not only be guaranteeing us access back in there for the future, but also for private folks to get back into their cabin sites or otherwise as well.
I understand that, and I understand your purpose here, but you do not lessen the uncertainty if your legal process is not perfect. And if your legal process is perfect, the uncertainty is gone. But you're essentially doing a quick claim deed here without using the full process. And my guess is, I don't know where you're getting your legal advice here, but my guess is that a little shortcut now may be big bucks later. And that's why I really question your process here.
Ms. Thomason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius. We will check with Judiciary and see what the process is and if there's been other examples where they've used certified or whatever, so that we're consistent in what we're doing here, so that we don't have a problem.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I don't see why I bring this up. I have got a, it's not a property right, it's a different kind of right, but a constituent who thinks she did not get a notice of a change in a pension plan. And it turns out that our state college system can't find any record of sending out the notices. Well, it also turns out there are lots of people in the same pickle. And I will be talking with staff next week about it, but I think just a little mistake on the part of the university system is going to cost us mega bucks when it didn't need to happen. And that's what worries me.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I ask my question, I would respond to something Representative Wagenius said. I think the major difference here is I'm assuming you would be using tax roll information to mail these things to the property people, and employment records are tough. People change in different things, but I think the one thing that we all realize is if you own a piece of land, you better keep your taxes paid and you better keep your address current where they can send that. My question to you, Mr. Thomason, or to Representative McNamara, when you prepare the map for the county or state, the roads that are here, it says that they'll be recorded with the county and stuff. Are the maps only prepared on a county-by-county basis, or is there actually a state map that shows all the roads in the state?
Mr. Thomason.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there'll be both. The official map, though, that would refer back to the specific legals and that sort of thing would only be on a county-by-county basis. Of course, we'll still have state forest road maps that will allow the public to know where the roads are in the state forest and throughout the state. and those might be on an individual state forest basis, and in some sense we might have other maps that would be statewide as well, just so that people can have an understanding of those.
Thank you.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too would hope that the bill might take a path through civil law. I have a concern about whenever we impact private property owners' rights without a whole lot of process. And 60 days to appeal the district court is a very, very short timeline for anyone. So I would ask you to consider making that longer, because it might take some time for a person to get the map. It's not 60 days from the person from the day that the person figures out that they're property's been taken on this map, but it's 60 days after the map comes out. And so my question is, what is the problem that's going on right now that this legislation is seeking to address? Thank you.
Ms. Thomason.
Mr. Chair, President, I'm glad you asked the question. We don't have too significant a problem right now. We've had a few situations over the past several years where our road use has been contested as land ownership has changed hands primarily. We get along real fine with the forest industry folks and with the counties and others where we're crossing parcels right now, largely because, again, we've established this traditional use that has been there for decades in most of these cases. The problem, the sense of urgency that we have relative to this, though, is especially related to the industrial ownership in Minnesota. As we're aware, there's over 1 million acres of forest land owned by industry, and that's scattered throughout the state. And in a lot of these parcels, our road system goes across industrial ownership. We want to make sure that for example, the 300,000 acres of Boise land in 5 to 10 years is subdivided and given out to, hundreds of small landowners in 160-acre blocks or something, that we're not in court fighting for our right to keep the traditional use that we're looking for. And I would emphasize the use that's currently in place, be it for management purposes only or for the broader use of public access, is all we're looking for. We're not looking to change that through the process or anything relative to it.
Representative Hortman.
Just to follow up, it's just a dramatic change in property law. To get an easement by use, takes many years of hostile, open, obvious possession that's known to the landowner. And this changes what I believe, if I can remember property law from 15 years ago in law school, a 15-year process to potentially a 90-day process for a landowner. So I think we have to be very cautious when we're talking about private property owners' rights and extinguishing any portion of that set of rights in a 90-day time period.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Craig Engwell from the DNR Commissioner's Office. Representative, we're open and go to judiciary and looking at the due process issues in much greater detail. What we did was we took I think this is literally the same process that the townships used to memorialize their existing road layer. That was the goal, so I want to be clear. We're open. If certified mail would be an improvement, we'll look at that. Again, sometimes legally sufficient to survive a challenge isn't always right. If we can have better process, we should look at that. So we'll be open to that as well. With the hearings, et cetera, to get input, if our inventory is wrong, we're not going to go forward on an assertion of a road if we're wrong. We're going to look the way we have this information backed up behind the inventory, behind the maps, behind the GIS, is a history of 50 years of timber permit sales, aerial photos. In the instances when we have had private individuals gate these long-term roads, that's what we've done. I've had a town board chair who lived on this road for 7 years testify that he had sales, that he bought permits to and use this road. So there'll be vast amounts of information behind the map itself, and that's what we want to share. And if somebody has concerns, we walk through that with them.
Representative Dale.
Thank you, Chair Harpart. Mr. Tomlinson. Last year we had some controversy about closing roads on the forest with gates. And were any state forest roads closed with those gates, and you know the ones we're talking about, were any state road, forest roads closed?
Ms. Hamilton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, we seasonally will close roads using gates or other means, but primarily gates, seasonally, temporarily, as the season warrants, related to either the road condition or fire conditions might warrant us restricting access, those sorts of things like that. That is a fairly small percentage of the overall 2,000-mile road system that has a gate up that is largely open most of the time and then only closed a few months of the year.
So, I'm a little concerned, and maybe you can take care of the concern. You know, we're pretty touchy about private property rights up where the woods are. And so you're asking for authorization to get a prescriptive easement across private land where a road runs. Now, let's assume that between the main thoroughfare and the DNR land that you're accessing with your forest road, there's a private parcel. Are you willing to give, are you folks willing to give a prescriptive easement to the private person on the DNR land so that they can get to their land? Because, I mean, I sense that if you, I mean, somehow there is, would be turnaround. I think it should cut both ways here. Because I've had reports, and you know this, that people have been blocked by gates that they can't get to their property. And yet, are they able to come and get a prescriptive easement for you across the, from you across the DNR land? The same way that you want to take it from them or get it from them.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'd envision there, and we as part of this process, this is part of several bills that are meant to clarify what our forest roads are, how they're designated, so that there's a brighter line for the public. For instance, we have another bill that would amend 8971. Right now, the way forest roads become forest roads are they're designated and they're used, and by operation of law, they become a forest road. It's not a quite clear process. Prospectively, we'd like that to be done by a commissioner's written order that's published and very clear, and that's how a forest road becomes a forest road. At the gates, too, we do temporarily close some roads when there's the frost going out, that type of thing. What I'd envision, if that's somebody's point of access to their property, is now we would give them a permit. We have the authority to give them a permit to use that to access their property. If the gate is closed for road conditions, we can permit access through a permit. But it's an existing legal road that the public would have a right to use, too. The only reason for closing it is to limit the damage to the road. And if there's an individual who needs to get there while it is closed, we could permit that activity.
My last comment on this, Mr. Chairman, is there's a lot of difference between an easement and a permit. And I think that it goes a long way to saying that there's a question here about the private property rights issue. And I want the forest road system to be in place and all of those things, but I'm just a little... I need a Pepto-Bismol on this one, all right?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand that too. And what's interesting is I was called by a county land commissioner who's interested in having the counties possibly having the same means to permissively use this process if they want, because as you know, they're vast county forest lands that they manage too, and they're facing the same circumstance. So I understand your point. It's well taken. And to the extent that the counties want to get involved in this process more too, we're open to that, obviously, as well. That, obviously, as well.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think we're all going to need some Pepto-Bismol without some more look at this language. And the more you testify, the more I'm concerned. The parts of these parcels of land have been sold, and we don't know what is on that recorded deed that was sold, say, from some big paper mill to the private party. We don't know whether they had noticed that there was a forest land road here or not. So I think there's some real questions here. Let me ask, did your assigned attorney general go over this in detail?
We've had discussions with, Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had discussions with the attorney general's office. And again, that's where the linkage to the township road statute was generated. We felt that was a good idea to memorialize something that exists using the same process that the townships did. When they started, township roads were recorded with the county auditor and not the county recorder. They were legally established at the time, but they didn't show up in the real property records. One of our main purposes in doing this is to have them show up on the county real property records so that otherwise this is just looming and looming and looming prospectively.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think you're right to go ahead and get it done. However, getting it done the right way is going to save huge headaches in the long run. And a township, I would say, is just different, not just because of scale, but because in a township area, folks probably know what's going on. You know your neighbors, you know who sold the property and all this. You have, in jumping to this scale that you're jumping to, which is huge compared to a township, I think you lose too much in being able to, I think your process is much too shortened and would not be acceptable to a court. So you might go through the whole thing and a court would say, no, throw the whole thing out.
Ms. Tomlinson.
Taken property routes without enough notice.
Ms. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis, your point is well taken. That's why I think we've designated that it could be a county level or something smaller than that if determined to be appropriate by the commissioner. The other, so we might do that on a state forest by state forest basis. Within Pine County, I think we have three or four state forests, if I'm not mistaken, or two or three. And maybe we take just one of those at a time rather than trying to do the whole county and have a more reasonable scale like you suggest that we probably work with. The other point that I want to make with this too is we don't envision going out and doing this in the next year or two or even three. What we're doing here is laying out a process for us to follow over the next several years and hopefully get there. And because we're not here asking for extra funding or otherwise to do it. We're going to do it with existing staff and resources. And we're going to plug away at this as it makes sense throughout the state and go through this official reporting process.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, if we could, is before it gets to Representative Tinglestad's committee, if it's the body's, the committee's wishes to move it forward, I'd like to work very much with Representative Wagenius, Representative Hartman, and Representative Dill's concerns. I think they all raise legitimate concerns about what we have going on here, and I think most of them are relative to judiciary and possibly GovOps, civil law. I think we need to review all that with all of them. So whatever you think, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative McNamara, I'm going to send the bill to Representative Tinglestad's committee, and you can work on these issues with those folks, and we can make changes along the way in those committees. But I'd like to move the bill along out of here today. Representative McNamara.
One more point, Mr. Chair. If you want, after we've been through those committees, I could check back with you and your staff and see if you want to hear it again if you think something.
You could do that, Ms. Representative McNamara.
I'll put my list of chairmen to check with.
Representative McNamara renews the motion that House File 1438 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Veterans Affairs. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed and sent to GovOps. Okay. Representative Johnson, I was worried we weren't going to get to your bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hill.
I'd like to move House File 1327 for Representative Johnson, and I don't know what you had in mind, but I would like to at least get it to the General Register if we can.
General Register?
Or the consent calendar, preferably, if that's acceptable.
Yeah, Representative Hill moves House File 1327 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, members. House File 1327. This is a DNR recommended bill that's aimed at meeting the City of St. Paul's needs during times of great emergency, such as terrorist threats, drought or contamination, and any such consumptive groundwater use will require DNR permitting approval. Now, currently, as most of you may or may not know, the city of St. Paul primarily pulls its daily supply of water from the Mississippi River. But the city also has groundwater wells that are now accessible in times of emergency. And what this bill will do will allow St. Paul to comply with consumptive use of groundwater requirements. That, in a nutshell, is the bill. And I have a couple here to testify as need be regarding the need for this bill from the St. Paul Water Utilities.
Representative Johnson, do you know where the bill is in the Senate? And is it moving through the committees? Is it on the general register or the consent calendar over there? Do you have any idea?
I'm not entirely sure at this point, but I think it's moving forward.
Okay. What do you have with you today? Who would like to start? Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Steve Schneider. I'm general manager of St. Paul Regional Water Services. And with me here, I have Dave Schuler, my chief engineer, also works for St. Paul Regional Water. Basically, what I'd just like to say is this year we requested from the DNR a change in our permit for the amount of water we can use from groundwater uses. We have the capacity to use up to a certain amount under permit from the DNR at this time. Any changes in our DNR permit from here on out would require us to get this bill passed, because the wells that we have in use now were drilled and installed prior to the law. I believe it was 1987 that requires this approval.
Okay. Anything further? Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Dave Schuler, chief engineer with the St. Paul Regional Water Services. Back in the turn of the 19th or 20th century, the St. Paul engineers created a supply up in the Rice Creek watershed, and that has been our alternative supply in the event of emergencies. That supply is no longer adequate due to the growth of the city. There's just not enough water, there's enough volume for an emergency. And it's quite polluted, so we really don't want to use that water anymore. So we need a bona fide backup, and we need average daily flow of 50 million gallons a day. We currently have 20 from groundwater, and so we'd like to boost that up to 50. And our vulnerability assessment that we performed in the event of 9-1-1, the terrorism on the United States, has really pushed us forward and made this a high priority.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. The Regional Water Services, does that apply only to St. Paul, or are there other communities that are affected as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we supply water to the city of St. Paul proper. In addition, we do supply water to all the first-tier suburbs, including the cities of West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, cities of Maplewood. We supply on a wholesale basis to the city of Roseville and the city of Little Canada. And the city of Roseville actually, in turn, sells to the city of Arden Hills. We also supply the cities of Lauderdale, and Falcon Heights. So that's why we did change our name about 7 years ago to the St. Paul Regional Water Services.
Mr. Chair, quick follow-up. And the Board of Commissioners, those are local elected officials within those communities that make the decisions as well, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. Our board consists of 5 members appointed by the city, by the mayor of the city of St. Paul, and also 2 citizen members of our suburban retail customers that we provide water to.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, to the testifiers, I'm looking at lines 13 through 15 and just wondering what would be maybe the maximum amount of time that this would be done, days, weeks, months, how would that be determined?
Mr. Schuler?
Are you talking about the well development?
As far as approving the permit, and for how long would it go?
It's going to be a long process over about 5 years. We have to drill, test, and look at hydraulic models of groundwater before we get final approval from the DNR.
Mr. Schneider.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think what you're alluding to is how long would we be required to use that alternate source?
Mm-hmm.
Hard to say in the event of what kind of emergency we would have at this point in time. But we would, assuming this this approval, we would have to work with the DNR to develop a new permit that would have caps on the amount that we can withdraw from the aquifer.
Okay.
And that would be based on a lot of studies on the aquifer and to make sure that it's adequate to supply those needs.
Thank you.
Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Johnson, I think this bill probably makes sense, but I just want to make sure when our farmers come forward and want ability to have permits to irrigate and things like that, that you're with us on that as well.
Right. Thanks for that. Did that. I appreciate it.
Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Dill renews his motion in House File 1327 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed to the general register. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, sir.
Members, that concludes the day. On Tuesday, March 15th, we're going to dedicate the entire meeting to House File 1547. And it's the annual ATV bill. And it's my bill. And members, we will be meeting in Room 10. Next Tuesday, we will be meeting in Room 10. With that, meeting adjourned.